Narcolepsy and the Flu, Free Speech Hypocrisy, and a review of this year's Ig Nobel Prize winners. Let's begin episode 184.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And this is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. So Ethan, we predicted it, and it's come true. You know the census, that sort of thing that used to be mandatory, but now has kind of become voluntary?
Actually, no, Don. I don't remember any census. We never had a census before. There was never a census.
Yes. Well, the way the government is currently treating it, you would think it's that sort of what's going on sort of thing, right? And actually, they've turned it now more into almost like a poll or something, you know? The census used to be mandatory until just last year when the government made it optional and you could fill it in if you do or fill if you won't. And one of the predictions was is that the data set we would get from that would become inaccurate and misrepresentatory. And it turns out, now that we've kind of got all the data in, that that's turned out to be correct. Apparently, the response rate was about 68.6% overall, but it dipped below 50% in a lot of the smaller communities. In fact, consistently, smaller communities, areas that tend to be more minorities, underprivileged and that, were underreported, which means that the data that Stats Canada is getting overlooks these people, which leads to them being more and more left out. And it's led to a sort of a statistical gray area, fog of war sort of thing that was totally unnecessary.
Well, I mean, it just goes to show you when you turn a sophisticated census program into a Facebook poll, you don't really get the same results.
No, exactly. And I mean, it's another one of those areas where, you know, penny wise, dollar foolish. And it's almost like a war on knowledge, war on science by the conservative government. It's just another representation. In fact, I think we had another sort of view on this, and this is more speculatory, so don't hold me to this sort of part of it. But I don't know if you've heard, but there's been the huge recall of beef products from XL something in Alberta. And one of the reasons that Canada Health authorities have sort of given is that they don't have enough inspectors to go out and check the meat, and they're sort of relying more on the company itself to do it. And this is a case where it's failed horribly, so horribly that the Americans had a recall out weeks before the Canadians had a recall, even though they sort of told the Canadians on the same day, hey, we've just detected E. coli and you should really recall these meats. And that the proceduralness was just so slow because the system no longer has the manpower to do the work.
I mean, again, it sort of represents that when you strip down the regulations and the enforcement that allows us to, say, prevent, dangerous food products to get on the market, when you strip those away and you rely on sort of the honor system, that doesn't really work too well. And of course, when you don't have, any kind of controls, then, well, I mean, it's really hard for business to moderate itself when it's motivating profit or motivating when its motivating focus is making money. They're not terribly concerned with, how safe is the beef.
And this just leads me to think, that if our government was wise, it may want to repent in some sort of way or achieve some sort of atonement for the wrongs that are currently being done. And this sort of resonates with an article or a story you've been reading, isn't it, Ethan?
Absolutely, Don. And it also ties into our show today on free speech. But let me take you to Montreal, where we almost had the start of a religious accommodation argument. Now, I say almost because this sort of resolved itself, but let me discuss the particulars of the case. So you had a Montreal City Hall meeting, and the plan was for this meeting to adjourn early in observance of the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur. Now, however, an opposition city councilor, Annie Sampson, called this, quote, unreasonable accommodation. Now, Quebec is a secular province, and city hall meetings are obviously secular institutions. So, therefore, it seems rather inappropriate for Montreal City Hall to have this break. In addition, there are many other different religious faiths in Montreal, and they all have their own unique religious holidays. So it was sort of like favoritism for the city council to only have these sort of breaks on some religious holidays. Now, Sampson also said that she recognizes that Yom Kippur is an important holiday for the Jewish community, but City Hall is a public institution. And, quote, we cannot put the city on hold for that to accommodate 3 of 64 councillors. Now, rather than imposing a holiday on everyone and paralyzing council, to quote Sampson, what she wanted to do was basically just have the people who wanted to abstain from the council, they could do so without penalty, and the rest of the council would continue on with their plans. The mayor, Rotron, said that the city charter of citizen rights and responsibilities calls on council to respect diversity and to hold council meetings in publics. Scheduling them on days when large portions of the public cannot attend due to religious obligations would be against the spirit of the law. He also said he was, quote, shocked by Sampson's objections, and he says he doubts a majority of councillors would support that view. Now, I mean, I mentioned how this was sort of a non-issue. Well, it turned out that the meeting finished early. Its agenda completed at around 4 o'clock, so there was really no reason to worry about it because Yom Kippur didn't start for another 2 hours. But nevertheless, I thought it was kind of interesting that this sort of debate came up in the first place. Now, I mean, whether or not Montrealers want to engage on this issue is, I think, rather irrelevant. Because if we're going to be talking about sort of a secular institution like a city council, then it's not really an issue of debate or determining what is the right course of action. It's a question of law. And if the law says that these institutions have to be secular, then I think it's you kind of do a lot of sort of hand-wringing to work in religious holidays, you know, to a council meeting.
No, you know, it seems like a bizarre thing. And I mean, you know, to sort of criticize someone for bringing it up seems like, you know, okay, I may not agree with you, but it seems like, oh my, how dare you even suggest such a thing? Seems like a weird overreaction.
Yeah, exactly. And that was the reaction that we saw, because when this counselor made this suggestion, she was accused of making an attack on the Jewish community. There were calls for her to apologize for, quote, absurd and insulting comments. It was suggested that these sort of things will cause a rise in anti-Semitism. I mean, some of the remarks were pretty
over the top.
Over the top, exactly. And it just kind of, I mean, like, is there no room to have a discussion on sort of secular issues without it becoming an issue of oppression and, you know, lambasting a religious group?
And, you know, it ties into another thing, which I think is not discrimination, but an inequality, is a lot of the Christian holidays, like Christmas, Easter, are like statutory holidays, whereas Yom Kippur, Ramadan, sort of the other religious faiths holidays are not actual statutory holidays, that there's going to be an innate inequality. But that being said, I mean, do they have a half day on Ramadan? Do they, you know, if All Saints Eve or something, do they shut down for there? I think that's where a rational conversation could have had, instead of what sounds like almost an ad hominem attack. It's, let's not talk about the issue. Let's condemn the person who's bringing up the issue for daring to be such a contrarian.
Well, actually, that's a good point. I looked it up, and the mayor made some quotes regarding that point about other holidays, and claimed that in the past, city council had adjourned for non-Judeo-Christian holidays, although he couldn't name an example. When you mentioned about the stat holidays, I mean, those are like legal requirements. So it really doesn't matter to a certain extent whether or not we want a secular point of view, because the letter of the law basically says you have to take a day off that day. And then the other interesting factor with this, I mean, being at Quebec, and, you know, Quebec's got sort of a interesting history when it comes to religious accommodation. There are certain areas here that we can examine. I mean, there have been cases where Quebec has passed laws that on the surface appear to resist a religious accommodation, but when diving into them, actually look like Quebec is sort of trying to egg on religious hostility. There were the laws that were passed a few years ago about wearing face veils for women in Quebec, and there was some line in the law about the only time that a woman wears a mask in Quebec is on Halloween or something. So, I mean, there is kind of this history of this almost double standard in Quebec, as well as, I mean, you know, criticizing a policy versus criticizing a person, and the traditional, you know, views of religious accommodation versus sort of a harder secular point of view that is not necessarily native to Canadian law in the first place.
To add a little bit of perhaps nuance or blowback or what have you, I mean, Montreal does have a very large Jewish community relative to the rest of the country, which is why this may have taken off more so than it really deserved to. But you're right. You're bringing up, you know, the veil laws. We talked on the show a little while ago about kirpans in the National Assembly. And what about with the PQ being elected and this idea of bringing forward a secular agenda to sort of rule over the separation of sort of church and state in government dealings? I mean, that would seem that this would have purchase in this particular area. What has there been much comment in the community about this in particular, or is it still too early days?
Well, I mean, the thing is, like, because the issue sort of resolved itself, it pretty much dissolved. And I looked at some of the commentary in some newspapers, but I mean, most of it was, it seemed like most people just didn't want to have the conversation. And I think it's unfortunate, because there definitely can be some taboo about bringing up a debate like this, especially when it focuses on a historically very oppressed group of people. That being said, I mean, if we can remove ourselves for a moment from making this about an anti-Jewish thing and making this about a secular versus religious traditional debate, which is where it really should be, then perhaps there could have been some conversation. Unfortunately, it just sort of seemed like people had this very knee-jerk reaction and then were, you know, wiping their foreheads because council adjourned anyway. So I think it's actually kind of unfortunate that we couldn't have that conversation in Quebec.
Well, you know, when we come back, I think we're going to talk about how there's this sort of tension between accommodation and the whole idea of sort of freedom and free speech and certain degrees of hypocrisy relating to them.
Sounds interesting.
We'll be back.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back. Free speech hypocrisy. I was reading a story at Slate.com by William Celatan, which I thought was interesting. It was inspired by a recent global uproar over the Innocence of Islam video on YouTube we covered on our own show previously. The point of the article was to point out the hypocrisy, or at least the inconsistency, of hate speech laws both in Europe and the Middle East. Now, he gave a pass a bit on the U.S. because of their First Amendment law, essentially makes any hate speech laws impossible to enact. So we're going to largely focus on the old world, as he sort of did in his article. Now, many of us have decried the violence that erupted in the Middle East over the, quote, insult to Islam this video embodied. There was much talk about the need for the, quote, backwards people of the Arab world to learn that a modern society tolerates speech it may consider offensive for the sake of the principle of free speech, which most Westerners consider to be one of the foundations of a democratic society. The hypocrisy arises when Celotan points out that in Germany and other nations, comments that attempt to minimize or contest Nazi crimes or communist crimes in other states can lead a person into jail, that a number of, quote, progressive European nations, Netherlands, UK, and Sweden, have hate speech laws that make it a crime to insult, degrade, or demean, sometimes even a gesture. And it kind of makes you wonder, you know, where is the tolerance here? Celotan presents a number of people who have faced criminal charges for these varied crimes, such as in Sweden, where a pastor called homosexuality a cancerous tumor, a Serbian mayor saying that homosexuals are a disease, a Basque artist who had a picture of 9/11 and put underneath the caption, "We've all dreamt it, Hamas did it." And of course, there are a number of people who have suffered because of their contentions about Nazi death camps, immigrants as pollution, and so on. The thrust of the story is to say, sort of pick one. Either you ban all insulting speech, thus banning the YouTube video, or you allow it all. This, I think, is sort of a great example of the logical fallacy of the excluded middle. He makes the argument that you either have free speech or not. There is no sort of middle ground. Yes, for the moment, we are ignoring the sort of yell fire in a crowded theater sort of problem, but should we? One of the things Celotan sort of gives no time to is to provide a context for the various laws. First, the extra sensitivity Germans have towards their Nazi past is because of their Nazi past. I mean, Germany, due to the Nazi regime, was the center of one of the most focused and meticulous genocides to happen in perhaps the history of humanity. Being guilty of this past crime, Germany is sort of on a societal probation where it must adhere to sort of a higher standard than a, quote, regular country. To a lesser but similar degree, the former communist and fascist dictatorships also have to pay special attention to sort of that slippery slope that their prospective countries have already sort of slid down in the past. That said, this only accounts for sort of a small number of hate speech laws. Does Celotan have a point about the rest of them? Yes and no. Another context that Celotan sort of excludes from his article is purpose. Yes, it is difficult to know what is in the heart of the speaker. That said, there's a clear distinction between hate and offense. Hate speech is not saying that you are stupid, that you believe in something that is false or wrong. It is not offending you by drawing a picture and giving it the name Muhammad. It's not saying a person is misrepresenting their ethnicity based on their appearance, or putting up a sign saying Islam out of Britain, all of which have caused problems legally in other countries in the past. Okay, those last ones are heading into that gray area where they are insulting and maybe offensive, but are they really hateful? And I think, I mean, maybe no. Hate speech is calling a person a cancer that needs to be removed. Those people are vermin and they need to be exterminated. They are cockroaches and we need to squash them. Now, these are things that have actually been said about people in the past, and they have an entirely different tone. There seems to be hatefulness and a need for legal redress in comments like this. If you say something like, you know, our country would be better if they went back to where they came from. Those people are stealing our country from us. They use their money to buy our government. Those are more gray areas, but there's definitely sort of an arrow pointing at not just sort of an insult or offense, but a call to action. Hate speech implies violence. Ironically, the U.S. actually provides some great guidelines for sifting these shades of gray. Illegal hate speech needs to advocate or encourage violent acts or crimes of hate and create a climate of hate and prejudice, which in turn fosters a commission of a hate crime. Now, this is one of the things that one of their departments of communications had come up with, saying, hey, this is how you can kind of – it's one of those ways that you can square the circle where you can allow people to exhibit their free speech while still ensuring that people are not actually threatened or have to worry for their life. Put another way, it seems necessary to confront people, irrespective of their personal beliefs, in things that are like false facts or flawed arguments. We should be tolerant of divisive and bellicose language. We need to separate people from things. If I insult Muhammad, Jesus, or the Book of Mormon, three of it, if I decry an institution, the church, the Conservative Party, that does not necessarily translate into an attack on people who support or are members of that group. Saying Moses was a bigot is not saying that all Jews are bigots, even if it is intended to show the moral flaws of the Abrahamic religions. The comment is on the mythical being and the institution and not on the people or individuals. That said, when a comment or argument advocates violence or dehumanizes an individual or group, we've crossed the line there. If a comment that the god Mars ate live babies and those who worship Mars should be shot or they are inhuman and they should be removed from society, lines have been crossed. Hate speech should not be tolerated, but offensive language should be. Any particular speech does not in a binary sort of way fall into one category or other. It is sort of a 50 shades of gray sort of event. So how do we adjudicate this sort of gray area? Well, fortunately, here in Canada, we have actually a legal basis. It's called the Oakes Test, and it's one of the things that's in our constitutional law. So basically what it states is that, you know, that a restriction must be sort of rationally connected to the aims of preventing violence. So you just can't sort of randomly say, hey, you've called for us to sit in city council on Yom Kippur, that there is somehow offensive. No, it has to somehow advocate violence. And in that case, I can't see where there would be. It also needs to be sort of minimally restrictive as possible to sort of achieve the aim of preventing the violence. And the restriction must be sort of proportional to the actual harms that it's intended to prevent. So you know, these are all rational things. And the legal weight of them, how you actually go about applying these, is a part of Canadian constitutional law and can be a great example for the rest of the world to sort of use and say, hey, guys, it's really not that hard. It seems an easy target to decry the violence of the recent weeks over the YouTube videos. But again, we must remember the context. These protests are fueled by people both locally and internationally who wish to gain influence and notoriety from the violence. Be it in a producer of the video itself, an imam who makes sure everyone knows about the video so as to increase attendance to their services, or a Christian pastor who promotes, quote, the truth of said video for the same reason as the imam. Before we are quick to condemn things like this YouTube video and the violence over that, we need only think about the violent protests that erupted over the, quote, 9/11 mosque that never was real, or the assassinations or bombings perpetrated by anti-abortion Christians, or even, I don't know, you might have some suggestions here, Ethan. I mean, it's not all sort of violent radicals or Arabs even. There's a lot of shades of gray here.
Well, yeah. And I think that's something that was missed in this article. If the dichotomy is either free speech or censorship, I mean, that's a massive oversimplification of the issue. And I think it speaks to a misunderstanding of sort of the nature of hate speech laws. I mean, you mentioned how it needs to advocate violence, or at least lead to violence. I mean, we know for a fact that one of the ways that you sort of rile up a group of people to commit an atrocity is you don't start at, you know, level 10. You start at level 1 and you build them up. So we do know that when someone makes these sort of vaguely racist, bigoted comments, those actually are harmful. But the law on the books is on the extreme end. And I think that it's up to sort of the more rational, reasonable people to provide a counterbalance to the low end of the spectrum and the sort of legal side to act as a counterbalance to the extreme examples. I mean, you mentioned some of the lines about referring to people as vermin, as referring to them as pestilence. I mean, that is textbook dehumanization, which has been shown. I mean, if you read Steven Pinker's latest book, has shown to lead really easily to making it okay to go up to someone who you've just called a cockroach and like hit them with an axe or something. So, I mean, as humanists, we have to counter the vaguely racist and misogynist and bigoted remarks that we see in popular culture. And legally, we need to have laws in place that can counter when somebody is going out of their way to dehumanize a human being for the purpose of ostracizing them, for the purpose of isolating them. And that's something that I think is being missed by this article completely.
You know, exactly, you know, and it can be uncomfortable because there does need to be a certain tolerance for feeling insulted for that. And I mean, there are social remedies for that. I got sort of a kick out of a recent article I read about Bolton, former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., saying that, you know, Obama has a limp-wristed approach to the Middle East or something like that. And there was a big decry about how this was such a horrible, insulting, and terrible comment. And I'm going, it's not that bad. I mean, okay, it's a little offensive, and it seems, you know, not a good thing for society to imply that members of the LGBT community are somehow inferior in the sense that they're less likely to go beat up somebody, which was sort of the intent of it. But, I mean, it was not saying, hey, look at that gay guy over there. Let's go kill him. I mean, it was just it was insulting. It was not very nice to say, and there was a lot of implications. But I mean, it was no way sort of hate speech. And there are ways to sort of rectify that. In an odd, I mean, I've just complained about how they were making a big deal out of it. But I mean, that's where the uncomfortableness when it is bad sort of kind of insult comes into it, where people say, hey, you know, you shouldn't do that. And we'd rather you didn't do that. And there's this sort of sense of social isolation in the same way that you might get someone who tells really bad sexist joke at a convention or something.
Exactly.
But you wouldn't criminalize it, you know?
And that, to take it back to the Montreal thing, like that's, I think, the missed opportunity here. I mean, if we like, I don't know the history of this counselor, but I don't think they were trying to be an anti-Semite. But even if they were, I mean, if that conversation could have happened, then there was that public forum for that discussion. You know, it by bringing it out and discussing it, we learn about this person, we learn about the issues at hand. And, you know, if it had just been like, okay, this person's going to jail now, or they shut down the conversation like they did, it just kind of, it leaves lingering hostility, I think. And, you know, as skeptics, I think that, you know, we should be aware that sometimes an argument can actually do good. So I don't know. Like, it bugs me when I see this sort of false dichotomy of free speech and like censorship, and that it's one or the other, pick one. It's like, no, I want it in the middle.
With our hate speech laws, there's a very important principle. Some people say, well, you shouldn't charge these people because you're just giving them sort of a platform to spew their hate. But our Canadian legal system says, no, no, we need to have this conversation. We need to bring it out in the open so people know what's going on. And a rational, objective mind will be able to assess what's being said and take it for the crap that hate speech would really be. Or they might say again, hey, you know, he said something offensive, but it was not hateful.
There definitely can be a benefit to having not necessarily a forum, but just a method of knowing what kind of offensive speech exists. And I mean, there is some debate about whether or not that's accomplished by our current system or if it's accomplished by other factors. But nevertheless, I mean, it certainly is an important factor for combating racist, misogynist, whatever language that exists. So, yeah, absolutely.
What do you know? You're just a ginger.
Hey. Only a ginger can call now ginger.
So we're going to go for a break. When we come back, we're going to try and stay awake because some of this conversation could just.
Best tool ever devised. understanding how the world
to subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
That understanding empowers you.
Today in the news.
And today in the news.
Today in the news.
Tired of the same few voices giving you the same point of view on the news? You're not alone. The Campaign for Democratic Media is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group fighting to ensure that our public airwaves represent more than just one voice. Canadians deserve diverse, accountable, and quality Canadian media. Visit democraticmedia.ca to learn how you can stand up for media issues.
We're back. Sorry, I sometimes just sort of fall asleep for the sake of a segue. We're going to talk about vaccines and narcolepsy. I think we did talk about this before, but there's been some new information. Now, as our fans know by now, I spend a lot of my time listening to podcasts, scanning internet news sites for interesting stories to delight our listening audience. One source I like to use is Real Story. I've often found it to be a source of a number of investigative articles presented here for your edification. That said, you must always keep your eyes open even from trusted sources. One of the sources Real Story often uses is the Agence France-Presse. The article that I read claimed that there was a link between the H1N1 vaccine and narcolepsy. In Finland, 79 children, and in Sweden, close to 200 children under the age of 19, developed narcolepsy after receiving the Panderix vaccine in 2009 and 2010 as part of those countries' sort of response to the swine flu pandemic. It stated that the European Center for Disease Prevention and Control linked the swine flu vaccine used in the 2009-2010 pandemic to a higher risk of the sleeping disorder narcolepsy. Well, I thought, did it? So I went down and I tracked down the European Center for Disease Prevention and Control's article. Now, I should point out that that this is an important story to kind of get right, because you just know that the anti-vax movement is going to pounce on this and they're going to say, hey, see, we were right. Vaccines are unsafe. So as I said, I tracked down the article, which was the technical report in brief, narcolepsy in association with pandemic influenza vaccine. A very boring, put you to sleep sort of title. Okay, so first, the facts as stated, i.e. the number of cases, is pretty much right. There was a notable increase in the prevalence of narcolepsy in the Scandinavian countries. Iceland, although not part of the study directly, was reported in other ancillary documents as having an increased presence of narcolepsy. The temporal relationship seems quite sound. So, you know, there was an increased number of cases consistently occurred about 2 to 3 months after the vaccination. Now, before we blame the vaccine, it is interesting that the study included actually 8 countries. And of those, only Sweden and Finland had any significant increase in the number of cases. The vaccine in question is used by 1 in about 20,000 children around the world without it raising any concerns. Although the agency did sort of recommend further studies, and they actually included Amperex, which is a very similar compound that's used here in Canada and Brazil. But essentially, outside of these two sort of isolated countries, there has not been a global pandemic.
Narcolepsy,
thank you. Well, not the H1N1, that was a pandemic.
Yeah.
But narcolepsy was localized.
Yeah.
It also did not recommend the cessation of using Panderix vaccine, nor did it actually claim a causal link. So this is one of those cases where you have correlation versus causation. Now, of course, the article did imply that there was such a link by stating that, quote, the Finnish and Swedish governments have both agreed to provide financial compensation for the affected children after their own national research showed a link between the inoculation and narcolepsy. Again, link, not causation. My research showed that this may not be sort of completely true when you think of the causation argument. Both the Finnish and Swedish government's health services acknowledged the link, between vaccinations and narcolepsy, but that only really 15 people in Finland had been paid any kind of compensation. Well, each government still recommends vaccination, pointing out that at least in Finland, that almost 60 high-risk people didn't die due to the vaccination. So there's this sort of cost-benefit analysis. The implication being is that, like I say, the risk is worth the reward. The payouts also seem to be part of sort of an insurance claim as opposed to an admission of failure. What I mean by that, any medical, hell, anything you do has some risk. In Finland, they have this thing called the Finnish Pharmaceutical Insurance Pool, which ensures that anyone who may have suffered due to a rare risk will receive some compensation, irrespective of the overall safety of the treatment in question. Okay, so that's where you think the story would end, but it got more interesting. So I did a bit more research, and I discovered that there's this Dr. Emmanuel Mignot, who has been doing research into the connection between respiratory infections, genetics, and narcolepsy. In a paper published in the Annals of Neurology about the increased occurrence of narcolepsy in China following an H1N1 epidemic, Mignot discovered that there may be a genetic disposition to narcolepsy triggered by upper airway infection. And no, the vaccines were not the same that were used in Finland. In fact, there was no association with vaccination at all in the underlying flu infections in China. So if the H1N1 and other such flus can trigger narcolepsy in a vulnerable population and genetics are involved, that might explain why people who had this sort of Viking heritage were affected while the rest of them were not. So in a sense, sort of mystery solved, and it looks like the vaccine itself wasn't actually the cause. It was simply a correlation. It was the infection itself, the actual sort of flu that triggered a genetic predisposition in a particular population, and these people happen to also have been in given the vaccine, and that's where you get the sort of correlation causation confusion.
Yeah, I mean that's pretty interesting. It kind of mirrors what happens in the States as well. Even sort of prior to the rise of the anti-vax movement, they basically set up a vaccine court in America. And the reason they sort of had to do this was because no drug company anywhere would risk litigation over vaccines. Because as you say, there's a very small percentage you're going to have a bad reaction. And, you know, it could range in what kind of reaction you're going to get. So they came up with this vaccine court, which basically is just a handout. And anytime you have something that happens after a vaccine and you're able to sort of establish a link, not necessarily causation, but a link, you get a certain payout, which is, I think, was capped at around $30,000 or $60,000 or something. And it was protection for the drug companies. And it was also sort of this bizarro court that existed outside of normal criminal law in the first place. And then when the anti-vax movement hit, well, this court was kind of indunuated with, you know, the crazy claims. But it does, it's a very similar situation because even if the H1N1 vaccine had a link to narcolepsy, as you say, it's incredibly difficult to tease out exactly what is that link. I mean, you mentioned that it was isolated to Finland and Sweden. I mean, for all we know, it could have been like an ingredient that was for some reason being used in those countries but nowhere else. I mean, these type of things will have a massive impact. One of the big vaccine disasters was related to the polio vaccine being transported in material that was dirty, basically. And it really didn't have anything to do with the vaccine. It was just the fact that the transportation of it screwed it over. So, I mean, yeah, it's really, really actually interesting that the explanation in this case happens to be a genetic predisposition instead of, you know, something related to the vaccine itself.
Well, to be fair, that's my take on the research, not that it's been proven. In fact, one of the things that's kind of made this more complex, one of the things that I fear is going to be fodder for the anti-vax movement, is because there was this initial correlation, again, Sweden and Finland being very socially sort of progressive countries and saying, hey, if you're a member of our society and you get ill, we will take care of you, initially came out and said, oh, yes, it looks like the vaccine cause this narcolepsy, and we will take care of you. And again, it's that confusion of the correlation versus causation sort of mindset.
Well, I mean, I think there has to be some accommodation on that, simply because most, you know, I think enlightened nations, vaccines are fairly mandatory. So, I mean, if you're in a position where, you know, you have a kid or something and you have to get them vaccinated, and then something goes wrong and you have an adverse reaction, I mean, I think you probably do have a case to be made that you should be compensated for that, you know, especially if that child is going to require long-term treatment. The question, of course, is, was it the vaccine, or was there another area or another level to the that caused this effect, right? So that's the difficult issue to tease out. And unfortunately, science doesn't work very fast. So, I mean, this could take a couple of years before they actually unearth the real culprit here.
You know, and it adds another layer just to make this. I mean, we wish things were just sort of black and white. It makes life simpler. But another factor that comes into this, which people should be aware of, is that when you do get vaccinated, about 90% of the people who get the vaccine, the immunity takes. But the other 10%, for one reason or another, you know, the immunity doesn't take. And it was pointed out that of the people who are suffering the narcolepsy, 90% of them got vaccinated, which, of course, led me to go, wait a minute, that seems kind of, I mean, if the vaccine causes it, 100% had to have been vaccinated. But I couldn't track that line down a little bit more. But let's go with that to begin with. So these people still could have been vaccinated and still caught the H1N1 flu, and ergo they got the disease. And the other aspect, which I've already mentioned loosely, is even if you assumed they did get the narcolepsy from the vaccine, full stop, there is that cost-benefit analysis that, okay, 15 people suffer narcolepsy, which is an inconvenience, but with proper medical treatment can be easily dealt with, as opposed to 60 people who would have died. You know, it seems like a fair shake, no matter how you split this particular pineapple.
Well, yeah, and if we even, I mean, 60 is a lucky number. I mean, if the H1N1 had gone like Spanish flu, and, you know, wiped out, you know, 30% of the population, I think that there's a certain collateral damage we're willing to take. And that sounds like a horrible thing to say, but I mean, honestly, we can't, when you're thinking about this level of concern, you know, you sort of stop thinking about individuals and start thinking about like a whole city or a whole country of people being wiped out. And that sort of pushes you into a different, you know, a different catalog of numbers, basically, when it comes to, you know, risk and odds and that sort of thing.
I wonder if it was a Black Death, would they have done it?
Well, if they could have had a vaccine for the Black Death, I don't know. That's a good question. I wonder what the Catholic Church would have said about that.
Interfering in God's plan
to kill you.
Well, you know, he gets lonely up there. He needs people to visit. And he gets bored real easily, so he keeps having to get new people to come up there, and that's sort of the circle of life. It's God's cocktail party in the sky.
Yes, with a very short attention span.
And for people with a very short attention span, we're going to go for a break, and we'll be right back after this.
Canada pays some of the highest cell phone fees in the industrialized world. And now the big three companies that control 94% of the market want us to pay more? Using high-priced lobbyists, the big three are trying to trick the government into shutting out independent competitors. If they succeed, they will squeeze more money out of your wallet and squeeze Canadians into tighter contracts. Send a message to the industry minister. We want competition. We want independent providers. Stand up. Sign this urgent petition. Visit stopthesqueeze.ca.
And we're back. Then we're going to do a brief rundown on the Ig Nobel Prizes. It's sort of the comic version, roughly speaking, of the Nobel Prizes. The Ig Nobel Prizes honor achievements that first make you laugh, then make you think. The prizes are intended to celebrate the unusual, honor the imaginative, and spur people's interest in science and medicine and technology, and essentially just to have sort of a bemused laugh at what some people do as research. And it's real research. It's not a waste of time. Although they have done some Ig Nobel Prizes on quack medicine and woo science and all that. But usually they've gotten kind of serious about being respectable, if I can use that word, while at the same time trying to make us laugh off the chair.
Well, sometimes they give out ignoble prizes as sort of a backhanded compliment way to sort of make fun of pseudoscience.
So, again, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this. For some of our listeners who don't know of the Ignobles, we just kind of want to let you know that they're out there. And you can find out more. Let us know. Send us an email at info@radiofreethinker.com. And, you know, we can elucidate a bit more about these. A number of people who listen to our show have already heard the Ignobles done on their other 50 million podcasts. But for those who haven't, let's go down what some of the prizes are. So in the Peace Prize, an award was given to a company that converted old Russian ammunition into diamonds. I mean, isn't that wonderful that they did that? In fact, I haven't quite figured out what the funny part of that. I think they were going more for irony or something, but they do a lot of weird things like that.
Need a good James Bond quote to go with that one.
Yes, and a cat. You know, diamonds are, I've got nothing on that.
From Russia with Love.
Yes. Acoustics. The award went to something called the Speech Jammer, which may be showing up at a protest near you or just maybe at a public library. This wonderful machine disrupts a person's speech by making them hear their own spoken word with a slight delay. So imagine sort of having your microphone and your speaker on at the same time, and there's that sort of little delay and you hear yourself speaking. Apparently, if done right, just totally corrupts the way you speak. It's great, right? Some of the uses I heard about it was, you know, if you're sitting there and you're on the bus or the library and, you know, you got that person on the cell phone and they're just being way too loud, you kind of point the speech jammer sort of device in their direction, and they just can't speak anymore. It just totally jams them up. In neuroscience, and this is one of the ones I kind of loved, and if we had a bit more time, we might talk about it a bit more, but I think we've covered it before and it's been done a lot. It demonstrated that a brain researcher could, by using complicated instruments and simple statistics, find meaningful brain activity anywhere. And in there anywhere was a dead salmon. In fact, I think this was replicated by someone who used a jello mold to do the same thing. And the idea is that, you know, we have a lot of very complicated electronic diagnostic equipment, and it gives you a lot of data. And if you sort of look at it simplistically, or you manipulate it in a very, well, not quite dishonest way, but in a poor way, you can find anything in the numbers. It's kind of that whole idea. Statistics can prove anything you want.
You can also see patterns in almost anything as well. So there's probably some of that as well.
Exactly. In the old days, you'd watch the white snow on TV, but you don't really have that anymore with cable. But you get the idea. In chemistry, the prize went to someone who found out why houses in a particular town in Sweden were turning their hair green. And again, this is one of the ones that sometimes are good, sometimes they're a little bad. Ethan, can you guess why their hair might have turned green?
Gee, that's a tough one. I'm going to say they ate a lot of cabbage.
Wow, that would be good if it was a bit more east. But no, it was copper in the water, which to me was like, well, that would be one of the first things I think about, because oxidized copper turns green and it's water and you're showering it. But this was a big mystery and they solved it. The award for physics was given to someone who calculated the balance of forces that shape and move hair within a human ponytail, which we've been really needing. And this is one I think exemplifies the one that where you kind of laugh first and then you go, One of the reasons why they did this particular research was when they sit there and you do the CGI, you know, the computer animation, you want it to make as realistic as possible. So one of the areas where they're trying to do is like, how does hair move so that when we create these fake people, their hair moves the same way real people move? And that's quite interesting. In the fluid dynamics, they did a study about sloshing liquids to learn about what happens when a person walks while carrying a cup of coffee. And in particular, I believe that one was entitled Walking with Coffee, Why Does It Spill? which in some ways you think, well, it must be obvious, but it's one of these areas, hey, no one ever thought of actually going into it. Another one that I thought was actually humorous, it was a discovery that chimpanzees can actually identify other chimpanzees individually by seeing photos of their rear ends. So instead of having the Facebook or a mugshot of faces, if you're a chimpanzee, you can have a mugshot of asses and it will work just as well, which I thought was funny.
Chimpanzees are perverts.
Yes. Another one, which again, on the surface, sounds a little silly, but actually had some seriousness to it, was in literature. And it was a report about reports about reports that recommended the preparation of a report about the report about reports about reports. Essentially, this is one of those things that, you know, if you write a report, then someone says, well, was that report worth writing? And then someone says, well, you know, in order to do that assessment, we need to have a standardized set of criteria to assess the report and make a report about that report. And this goes on, well, how do you make a report about the report? And it sort of, one thing leads to another, and it's funny, but it has some uses. Now, of course, the one that left me just sweating in fear, because as you get older, things like this you start getting, was the one for medicine about advising doctors who perform colonoscopies how to minimize the chances that their patients will explode. Holy shit, pardon the pun, that, you know, you sit there and you go for a medical treatment and you have to worry. Not only do you get put through this rather horrific sort of invasive sort of procedure, but now you have to worry about exploding. And apparently it's rare but not uncommon for this to happen. And essentially what it is they put the little scope up the butt, and sometimes they have to cauterize. You know, if you've got a cyst or you've got some other sort of imperfection, they use sort of the electric arc to kill the bad cells and to seal the wound all sort of in one thing. Well, also in your digestive tract, there's this thing called methane. And apparently in a number of cases, this can actually lead to literal explosions. And no, it's not like you get guts all over the floor. It's not a bad Monty Python. Would you like a mint wafer, a thin mint with that or anything? Although when I first read that, that was the first picture.
That's exactly what I thought about too. It's just like, boom.
But no, most of these are just they're little pops. Occasionally you'll rupture the intestine, and that of course can lead to some serious infections. But from my sources, apparently only really one person has died in this in the last year at least. So it's not a huge issue, but it's one of those things, you know, if you want to minimize it, it's good to minimize that.
Minimizing explosions is always a good thing.
Always a good thing. And they had one other one for the Eiffel Tower that apparently leaning to the left makes the Eiffel Tower seem smaller. And that just struck me as, oh, that's an interesting idea about the mind. So those are the ignoble prizes. They make you laugh. They make you think. And in an odd sort of way, you can't wait for next year's because, you know, there's got to be more stuff like this on the way.
Absolutely. So I guess we're out of time here on Radio Free Thinker. We should go on to our skeptical highlights. So my highlight this week is a new book. It's called The Master of the Mountain, Thomas Jefferson and His Slaves. This is a new book about Thomas Jefferson, and it presents an interesting idea. Is or was Jefferson a benevolent slave owner? Well, not according to this book. It alleges that generations of historians have been covering up Jefferson's dark side, that he wasn't a lenient, soft-hearted, reluctant slave owner that he's been made out to be. The book by Henry Weinrich, a historian, is available now. It sounds very interesting. And actually, I think we've mentioned on the show in the past some of the controversies about Thomas Jefferson and sort of the sort of historic game of kind of erasing his past dark side, as the book sort of alluded to. And it sounds really interesting. I encourage any listeners to check it out, as you know, it's always interesting to learn about some of the sort of superheroes of history are not exactly the greatest people in the world. So check it out.
You know, and I would add to that. I mean, one, whenever you can learn something about any history, that's a good thing, but it also can provide sort of a case study about how history can be changed over time and how the particular perspective of the person creating the history is actually doing that. There's a huge amount of creation when it comes to writing history. We kind of think, well, they uncover these sort of objective facts, and they just present the facts. But so much of history is interpretive, contextual, what you include, what you exclude. And this seems to be a good pushback, because in the United States there's a lot of this exceptionalism going on right now. And it does. It strikes me as something that I would find interesting to read as well. I have a highlight I have to bring up is something that I discovered this week about myself, or the last week. It's about face blindness. Now, there's a website you can go to test what they call prosognosia. Essentially, face blindness is one of those things that where you can't really recognize people's faces. And they come in varying degrees. There's some people who literally cannot see a person's face, or it's like a blur to them. That doesn't mean they can't recognize people. They use things like hairstyle and the voice and other mannerisms. So, I mean, it's not like they bumble around and don't know anyone, but they can't really use their face. And I went and I took the test myself. And although I apparently have a great ability to recognize a face, I represented about, you know, the top 30% of people for that. But when it comes for me to recognize any one person's particular face, I'm like in the lowest 10th percentile. It's like Ethan, you know, when we meet on the street, odds of me knowing that it's you is like, you're lucky. You're lucky I've ever noticed you ever, even in the studio.
That's very interesting, considering that you like bumped into me a few days ago.
Yes, but it was your hair and your mannerisms that I recognized, not so much your face. Weird.
Yes, my confident stride.
Exactly. So I'm going to put the link up on our website about people who are interested in this face blindness. It also has some links to some tests, and you might be interested just to find out where you sit on this particular area. So as Ethan said, we're out of time. So this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
And this is Ethan saying, thanks for listening, and tune in next week.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. Of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite interrelation.
Melanie says, can you make a song about the hate?